The first reading this morning is from the essay Blood and Breath, written last year by Barbara Alice Mann, who teaches up in Toledo, Ohio, and is an expert on the mound-building cultures here in Ohio. And Judith will read this.
The first thing to understand is something so fundamental to Western thought as to be invisible to Westerners. That is the realization that the base number of their culture is one, as evinced in such ideas as one God, one life, one way, one soul, one true love, and so forth. Now, in the West, the only accommodation of two is Manichaean. That is, if there are two of anything, one must be an imposter or a rival, a debasement, an evil to be driven out in favor of the one right thing. Native traditions assume a base number of two. There cannot be one unless there have first been two. The easiest way to explain this is through Iroquoian concepts of the direction of the sky and the split sky. East is meaningless unless west also exists. Only after we know the two may we know the one. It is through their cooperation that the single path can be described.
The second reading is excerpted from a very long speech by the 19th century man known to history as Chief Joseph, but to himself as Imutuyalalot. He was in every way the equivalent of Abraham Lincoln in leadership, in brilliance, in integrity, and in vision, but in many other ways, he was even a far more remarkable person.
If the white population wants to live in peace with the Indian population, we can live in peace. There need be no trouble. Treat all people alike. Give them the same law. Give them all an even chance to live and grow. All people were made by the same great spirit, Chief. They are all family. The earth is the mother of all people, and all people should have equal rights upon it. I have asked some of the great white chiefs where they get their authority to say to we Indians that we shall stay in one place while white people shall go where they please. They cannot tell me. I only ask of the government to be treated as all others are treated. If I cannot go to my own home, let me have a home in some country where my people will not die so fast. We ask to be recognized as human beings. We ask that the same law shall work alike on all. If I break the law, punish me by the law. If a white man breaks the law, punish him also. Let me be free, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade where I choose, free to choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my forebears, free to think and talk and act for myself. And I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. When white people treat us as they treat each other, then there will be no more wars. We shall all be alike, brothers and sisters of one father and one mother, with one sky above us all.
When I chose the theme for this month of September 2 years ago, and that theme is atonement, I was, of course, thinking about it as one of the significant words associated with this season in the Jewish tradition. Next week, after all, is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. But atonement is a word that also resonates within our own universalist tradition. The earliest major theological work in the American progressive tradition was called Treatise on Atonement by the universalist minister Hosea Ballou, and it was written in 1805. In this work, Ballou denied that God was a petulant being that needed to be appeased by the death of Jesus. Instead, he taught that real atonement is when we learn to love each other better, and that Jesus did not come to teach blood and fear, but love and community. Atonement, interestingly, is merely a distorted pronunciation of the entirely made-up word at-one-ment, a word first coined in 1525 by William Tyndale, the first translator of the Bible into English. He could not find a suitable word in English to translate the Hebrew word Kippur. That word translates into English, modern English, quite easily as to conciliate, to make peace between estranged parties. But in 1525, the first word, conciliate, had not made it into English yet, and the second was just simply too long of a phrase. So Tyndale invented a new word, at-one-ment, the capacity to be at one with a neighbor or with God. I was not able to find out through all of my research when the word was first pronounced with a long O, but I'd be surprised if Tyndale himself pronounced it that way, at-one-ment. This summer, a visiting friend brought me a book to read with the essay Blood and Breath within it, the source of the first reading by Barbara Alice Mann of Toledo. In her essay, she discusses the base number used in most Native American thinking, which is 2, she says. Then she tells us that the base number used by most Western thinkers is the number 1. Remember, she put it this way. The first thing to understand is something so fundamental to Western thought as to be invisible to Westerners. That is, the realization that the base number of their culture is 1, as evinced by such ideas as one God, one life, one way, one soul, one true love, and so forth. Now, for some strange reason, personally, I wondered about this one business for a long time. Whenever I see a bumper sticker proclaiming that there's only one way, I always immediately think, I don't see what sense that makes, since I can think of 100 ways right off the bat without breaking a sweat. Jesus, to me, is not the one way. He was an intelligent teacher of Jewish ethics, to be sure. But many other teachers taught just as beautifully. The word healthy is pretty singular in English, too. If you're sick, there's a great diversity of illnesses, a flu, a cold, a measles, mumps, chickenpox, shingles, migraines, or something worse. But when you're healthy, you're just healthy. When you get over any of these illnesses, you're healthy. You're singularly healthy. There's only one word for it. In the West, there's only one God appealed to by presidents and popes and pastors and imams and rabbis. Atheists say there is no God in the singular, and agnostics say they don't know whether or not God could be knowable, again, in the singular. No one seems to fret a great deal in the West about whether the deities Isis, Ashtarte, Baal, Zeus, Ganesh, or Kali exist or not. After all, a plurality of gods and goddesses is hardly worth the trouble to affirm or deny, because it's one that's important, not the many. There's just too many of them, and they're probably just symbols anyway, aren't they? There is only one true love, according to Western literature and culture. No one ever grows up, correct me if I'm wrong, no one ever grows up thinking, I want to have seven true loves in my life. We're only supposed to dream about the one and the only. Barbara Mann goes on to say, in the West, the only accommodation of two is Manichaean. That is, if there are two of anything, one must be an imposter, a rival, a debasement, an evil to be driven out in favor of the one right thing. I think she makes a great point. The Manichaeans, not very well known today, the Manichaeans she refers to were religious folks who lived a couple hundred years after Jesus, but died out technically as a group about 1,000 years later. It was a religion first taught by a prophet named Mani, about whom not too much is known with any confidence. Mani seems to have posited two gods, one apparently good, the god of spirit, and one apparently evil, the god of matter. They were equal in power, they were equal in smarts, and guess where they chose to fight their battles? Right here on our little world. But Ms. Mann is correct. One of the two gods was considered evil, worse than any devil, pure malice, a rival and a debasement, in man's words, to be driven out, she adds. Exactly, and that's exactly what happened. The last organized Manichaean groups assumed to be in the thrall of this purely evil deity were entirely killed off by the armies of the very poorly named Innocent III, Bishop of Rome, also known as the Pope, around the year 1200. It was a total genocide, the first one recorded in history. Men, women, and children, by their tens of thousands, wiped out because someone knew that they were evil. Good people, you see, seem to just know who the evil people are. It's those other people. And they know that they themselves are really good, and that everything belongs to them instead of to those other evil people. Truth belongs to them. Wealth, power, access, all the right notions. Now, as I thought of the word atonement or at-one-ment in the context of Native American thinking as outlined by Barbara Mann, I suddenly saw the number one in the middle of that word at-one-ment in a different light. I wondered all of a sudden what wisdom the Lakota, Iroquois, Wyandot, Delaware, Miami, Seneca, Miwok, Ohlone, Chumash, Dine, Hopi, and so forth might offer in religious dialogue with Unitarian Universalists, Christians of all sorts, and especially this week, Jews. Extra page in here. All of whom find this concept of atonement in their history. At-one-ment, conciliation, making peace between estranged parties. And that's when I ran across Chief Joseph's speech in Washington. I spent part of Tuesday reading this great speech. It took a long time because my eyes filled with tears and I had to stop now and then. It's simply that wise and that powerful, and I encourage you to read it. It's not difficult to find. I knew vaguely from high school about the Nez Percé people and some awful ambush they suffered, but I didn't remember much. Here's the story in brief. The Chutapalu people, or Nez Perce, or as they are called in English, Nez Perce, which means pierced noses in French, by the way, a rather confusing name for people who never pierced anything at all. I have no idea why they got called that. Lived on some expansive ancestral land up in the Pacific Northwest. They had about 200 permanent towns and villages. When gold was discovered on their land, the United States government decided they could all just live on a tenth of their acreage because the white settlers needed their land. Half of the Nez Perce agreed in a treaty to limit their land. Chief Joseph, however, was part of the group that refused to sign, saying he would not abandon his father's gravesite. He also said that he didn't believe that the Great Spirit gave one kind of people the right to tell other kinds of people what they should be doing. He used those words. When he said this, the general in charge of making sure that the Nez Perce complied with this new rule felt personally insulted, his authority challenged. Of course, the Nez Perce had already experienced many broken treaties at the hands of the United States government, so Chief Joseph's impatience was certainly well-fueled. Nevertheless, the general gave them time to pack as he nursed his own personal wound. But Chief Joseph had another idea. He decided to abandon his father's gravesite anyway, and he led his band up north toward Canada to settle there, Canada which offered more civil treatment to the First Nation peoples in the first place. After a long and terrible trek, during which over 200 of the people died, they were finally surrounded and apprehended a few miles from the Canadian border, and then all of them were forced to move to Kansas, a land I don't have to remind you does not resemble the Pacific Northwest land at all, where the great majority of them died of smallpox in the following years. Chief Joseph lost many people that he loved, and he famously promised that he would fight no more. But he did travel to Washington, D.C. to appeal to Rutherford B. Hayes, the President of the United States. For Chief Joseph, Imutu Yalatlat, the idea of atonement, of conciliation, of restoring peace between estranged parties was certainly possible, not by killing a prophet or sacrificing an animal, not by any kind of bloodshed or any kind of war. We can live in peace, he said to his white audience. We can live in peace. There need be no trouble. Here's how you do it. Treat all people alike. Give them the same law. Give them an even chance to live and to grow. I ask, could it be put any clearer than that? I really can't imagine how. The great chief continued, let me be free, free to travel, free to stop if I want to, free to work, free to trade where I choose, free to choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my forebears, free to think and talk and act for myself. And I will obey every law and submit to the penalty if I break that law. It seems very clear to me. But as you know, Native Americans never found at-one-ment with their white brothers and sisters. They found only betrayal, massacre, lies, arrogance, disease, and brutality. Now, it seems to me that I could wiggle out of any responsibility for that by saying, well, it's not my doing. My people were watching their flocks by night in the hills of Emilia, Italy, when Chief Joseph spoke in 1879. My grandfather wouldn't even be born for another 7 years. My people aren't like that. We're good people, and I'm a good person. I could also say, like I heard so many times this week on television and the radio, my great-grandparents weren't even alive when the Africans were enslaved in this country. I clearly have nothing to do with such evil. I'm a post-racial person, you know. I'm a good person. I could also say the same thing about what happened in Germany during the war, Auschwitz and all that. My family lived here then, not in Emilia. I wouldn't even be born for another 4 years after the gates of Auschwitz were pried open. I would never have done anything like that. After all, I'm a good person. And I know who the bad people are, too. Those Nazis in Germany and Austria, those plantation owners in the American South, those American troops in the service of the United States government, they are the evil ones. They're the ones who kill and betray and enslave. I, however, am a good person. This, Barbara Mann might say, is the problem with the number one being central in Western culture. This is the new Manichaeism. If I am right and good, you have to be evil and wrong. But unless some biologist in this room can quickly convince me that the general who attacked the Nez Perce and the German citizens who turned their Jewish and Roma neighbors into the Gestapo were made of different flesh than I am, were of a distinct species totally unrelated to me, I'm going to have to deny that common understanding. It seems to me in this season of self-reflection, so highly prized, understandably, by my Jewish brothers and sisters, that I would be a lot more honest if I could admit that I am both good and evil mixed. That yes, I didn't attack native peoples, enslave Africans, or kill cultural minorities in Germany personally, but that hardly means, in the words of Candide, that I am thus wise and pure and good. I simply am not. I am, after all, clear that I am caught up in the very systems of dominance and privilege which allowed, encouraged, and permitted very good people to do very bad things throughout history. And I am often unconscious about all of that, as Barbara Mann asserts. I may be a good person, but unconsciousness is not very good. I like what Chief Dan George says at the top of the orders of celebration you have in your hands. Can we even talk of integration until there is an integration of hearts and minds? Can we be at one in society if we are not at one inside of ourselves? In other words, as a Native American philosopher rooted in two, not one, Chief George does not imagine that we have a singular soul inside of us, but a double spirit, capable of both good and evil, quiet reason and noisy irritability, moral strength and wavering venality. I have to learn to integrate all parts of myself if I am to become whole, singular, round, and one. The two comes first, the one comes afterward. East can't exist without West, the Iroquois asserted, and my visions of justice for all people cannot be neatly sundered from my own neediness, my own self-pity, and my own indulgent fears, and my own submission to many larger systemic realities. At-one-ment cannot happen unless I first admit that I am two, not one. Just as the whole circle of the sky does not exist without the contrast of east and west, north and south, according to the Iroquois, my atoned self doesn't exist if I think that means that I am somehow without contrasts as well, purified completely and now utterly, utterly innocent and good. Atonement does not mean purity. It means learning to live peaceably with the estranged and shadow parts of myself, as well as the estranged parts of family and community. It means that I can never pretend that I'm invulnerable to the capacity to hurt others, to grow lazy, to make excuses, and to deceive myself and deceive others. My spiritual life, this season of Rosh Hashanah, tells me, is to be always on guard against excusing myself, thinking I'm finished, thinking I'm finalized, thinking I'm perfect and done. I've hardly written a new treatise on atonement here, a final chapter in Hosea Ballou's great work, so I will end with the simple words of Chief Joseph, which I grew to love so much this week. He's the real expert on at-one-ment in my book. All people were made by the same great spirit. They are all family. The earth is the mother of all people, and all people should have equal rights upon it.